people power.
Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the political divisions within the Iranian ruling elite made apparent by the rebuke to President Ahmadinejad, who on the eve of his trip to the United Nations announced the release of two Americans held captive, only to be overruled by the Supreme Leader. Nader Hashimi, the author of The People Reloaded, The Green Movement and the Struggle for Iran's Future, joins us. Then we'll get an update on the euro crisis from Matthias Venengo, professor of economics at the University of Utah, who's just returned from Geneva, where he was working for the UN Development Program. We'll examine the paradox of developing countries like China and Brazil propping up the sick economies of Europe and the United States, as well as try to find out whether the Europeans will get their act together before the eurozone crashes. Then finally, following the recent defeat of the pro-Israel Orthodox Jew running for a safe Democratic congressional seat, who was defeated by an even more pro-Israel Republican TV producer of the Jerry Springer Show, we will look into whether the perceptions that Republicans are more staunch allies of Israel than Democrats will play out in the 2012 election and affect what is expected to be a close presidential race. MJ Rosenberg, who worked for 15 years on Capitol Hill for a number of congressmen and senators and used to work for AIPAC, joins us. I'd also like to invite you to the Hammer Forum I am conducting next Wednesday, September the 21st at 7 p.m., America's Secret Campaign Against Al-Qaeda, co-presented by Penn USA. The two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times correspondent Eric Schmidt and national security expert John Mueller join us to discuss the war on terror. Eric Schmidt covers terrorism and national security affairs for the New York Times as the co-author of Counterstrike, the untold story of America's secret campaign against Al-Qaeda. And questioning the costs and strategy is John Mueller, author of Terrorism, Security, and Money, Balancing the Risks, Benefits, and Costs of Homeland Security. Again, next Wednesday, September the 21st at 7 p.m. It's free to the public, the Hammer Forum in Westwood. Hope you can join me. Let's now talk about the apparent divisions within the ruling elite in Tehran. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Nader Hashimi, who is a professor of Middle East and Islamic politics at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's the author of Islam, Secularism, and Liberal Democracy, Towards a Democratic Theory for Muslim Societies, and the co-editor of the new book, The People Reloaded, The Green Movement and the Struggle for Iran's Future. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nader Hashimi.
Glad to be with you.
And clearly the Iranian leader, if indeed we can call him the leader, has been rebuked, if not humiliated, on the eve of his trip to the United Nations. He promised the release of the two American hikers still held, and that was reversed. So give us a sense of what explains this division and dysfunction at the top of the power structure inside of Tehran.
Yeah, well, there are essentially two political camps within Iran's conservative establishment that have been at each other's throats since the spring of this year. There has been this sense that the camp of Ahmadinejad and his chief of staff have accumulated too much power, that they are trying to take Iran in a somewhat different direction, and the camp of his critics, which revolve around the office of the Supreme Leader and in particular Iran's judiciary, are trying to send a clear message to Ahmadinejad that power resides in the office of the Supreme Leader and that he has to be subservient to the wishes and whims of the office of the Supreme Leader. And so there has been this back-and-forth battle between the two camps that has now resurfaced in the context of these two American prisoners who were supposed to be released today, but it seems like their release will not take place until sometime in the future.
But this is not the first time there's been an excuse for either some kind of public rebuke or humiliation, or at least the appearance of a political excuse to get it at Ahmadinejad. I mean, his chief of staff has been a source of dispute. Now, apparently, some connection, however tenuous, to a massive amount of bank fraud is being used against him. Give me a sense of who's got the kind of tools, if you will, the political tools to win this kind of battle, because it seems to be being fought in many ways in a kind of Karl Rovian fashion. Would that be correct?
Yeah, I think that's correct. I mean, the people who have the political tools and the power to put constraints on the office of the presidency, Ahmadinejad and his camp, is really the office of the supreme leader and sort of more hardline, ultra-conservative elements of Iran's political establishment. And so you're correct. Charges are being brought up against Ahmadinejad and his staff for embezzling funds, for engaging in bank fraud, for promoting a deviationist interpretation of Shia Islam, for trying to take Iran down a different path. And so there has been these back-and-forth battles. Arrests of close allies and supporters of Ahmadinejad have taken place. And so what's supposed to happen next week is Ahmadinejad is supposed to travel to New York. And he has used these international trips to accumulate a lot of public attention, both globally and within Iran, to present himself as this regional leader who's standing up to the great superpowers. And he uses that international attention that he gets when he travels abroad to shore up support back at home. And so on the eve of this trip to New York, I think his critics in Iran, who are really centered in the office of Iran's supreme leader, are trying to humiliate him. They're trying to prevent him from scoring a public relations victory by having these American hostages released before he arrives in New York, and by making sure that they're not released before he arrives in New York, it complicates Ahmadinejad's foreign trip, because the first thing he's going to be asked as he gets off the airplane is what's the status of these American hostages. And that's a conversation he does not want to have. He wants to talk about other issues that he can win PR victories.
So, Nader Hashemi, again, professor of Middle East and Islamic politics at the Joseph Kobel School of International Studies at the University of Denver. I understood that one of the real powers here behind the scenes is the son of the supreme leader, who I believe was in the Revolutionary Guard Corps with Ahmadinejad. And what's the connection there? Have they had a falling out?
Well, see, yeah, no one really knows. I mean, in over the last 2 years, since the crackdown on Iran's pro-democracy movement, the son of the supreme leader, a man by the name of Mujtaba Khamenei, has emerged as this individual who apparently has played a very important and instrumental role in terms of presiding over the crackdown against the pro-democracy movement, and also sort of being his father's sort of go-to person, the person who really is running the office of the supreme leader, where most of the power is concentrated in Iran. Now, as to his relationship with Ahmadinejad before, in terms of their affiliation or connection when they were both in the Revolutionary Guard Corps, I think no one really knows for sure. That took place many decades ago. To what extent they had a close personal working relationship or not is unclear. Even the figure of the supreme leader's son, there has been no serious, I think, study or analysis of exactly what role he's playing exactly. They're just sort of rumors and innuendos, largely because, you know, Iran's political system is deeply authoritarian and access to information, particularly at the upper echelons of power, is very hard to come by. So no one really knows for sure, but there are these consistent reports and rumors that come out that, you know, this young man, the son of the supreme leader, is playing an increasingly important role in really sort of running Iranian politics, guiding Iranian politics, and leading the charge against Ahmadinejad and his camp.
So when you say that he's accused, Ahmadinejad and his camp are accused of being a deviation in Shia Islam, we know that he's a 12th-er, as they call it. He believes in the hidden imam's return, and apparently does so fervently. And sometimes when he comes to New York, he says some strange things about, I was surrounded by light, and all of these references to this sort of messianic interpretation of Shiism. But I thought that was, you know, that would be shared by the supreme leader. So where's the deviation?
Yeah, well, you're correct. It is shared by all sort of factions, political factions in Iran. The difference is the role that clerics should play in Iranian politics. The Ahmadinejad school of interpretation, which is known as the Iranian school of Shia Islam, have been articulating this new interpretation of Shia Islam that downplays and sort of denigrates the role that clerics should play in contemporary society. And that's the main point of difference. There is this sense that Yes, we all believe in the final 12th Imam who will return at the end of time. Since we know that is certain, we don't really need clerics to intervene in the interim. We have a sense of what the future will be like. So it's really an anti-clerical interpretation of Shia Islam that Ahmadinejad's chief of staff, who is really the Karl Rove figure here behind the presidency, who has been the focus of a lot of attention and a lot of criticism from the other conservative camp located in the office of the Supreme Leader.
Well, Nad Hashemi, I imagine that this would play well with the public, doesn't it? Aren't the public pretty disgusted with the mullahs? I mean, they've essentially taken over all of the mansions in North Tehran that the Shah's cronies had. They've taken over the foundations. They're basically the new parasites, aren't they?
No, you're correct. I think, and that's actually the deliberate calculation that is taking place. There is an attempt by the camp of Ahmadinejad to sort of draw upon the deep-seated anti-clericalism that exists in Iranian society, particularly among young people and the middle class, who are upset at the state of politics in Iran and blame the clerics for the crisis of state and society, and they're trying to draw upon it and appeal to that sentiment within society to say, look, you know, if you vote for us in the parliamentary elections, if you back our policies, we will, you know, promote a new agenda that that is more progressive, that is less encumbered by the intervention of the clerics, and this is the way forward for Iran's future.
Well, of course, it's a bit of an irony, isn't it, Nad Hashemi, that Ahmadinejad's the good guy in this, given the kind of press he's gotten internationally and the things that he said that have inflamed so many people.
No, it is ironic. It's ironic, but one has to keep in mind, you know, Ahmadinejad is a good guy only in the following narrow sense, when the two choices are between his camp and the camp of the Supreme Leader. But I think those are, you know, false options. There is a third option here, and that's the Green Movement. So, you know, one has to have a broader perspective. But yes, interpreted narrowly between these two rival camps, there is this sense that Ahmadinejad, at least, you know, has a different interpretation, a less clerical interpretation of religion and politics that he's trying to advocate. But it's pretty clear where the power lies, and that he has been forced to sort of tone down a lot of his political desires. And if one follows events over the last 3 or 4 months, the office of the Supreme Leader is the one that has asserted itself, and that is really, you know, winning this internal factional rivalry.
Let's broaden out then to the foreign policy landscape. The former head of Saudi intelligence, former Saudi ambassador to the U.S., had an op-ed piece in the New York Times this week that was very, very strong and very terse, warning the United States not to veto the Palestinian statehood, both of which are inevitable. He went on to suggest that the winners would be Iran and Syria. It's pretty clear that Iran is on the defensive about losing the Assad regime. They've sent about $7 billion to prop it up. They've sent in al-Quds people to help them crack heads and murder Syrian citizens. There's a split now between Hamas and the Syrians and by extension the Iranians over what's happening in Syria. Iran seems to be poised for a huge foreign policy defeat. And curiously enough, the United States, who's the, you know, obviously a main antagonist here, seems ambivalent about this. What's your interpretation of it?
No, you're correct. I think what's happening regionally, across the region, is that the Saudis are trying to interpret the Arab Spring as an attempt by Iran to expand its influence in the region. And it's trying to appeal to the United States and the West that if they're not careful, Iran can take advantage of opportunities to expand its influence. And so, you know, a lot of things are changing as we speak right now. And, of course, the big question here is the future of Syria. If Syria undergoes some sort of regime change, and I think we're still a long way from that happening, then, of course, everything is up for grabs in terms of the future political regional alignments and forces that might emerge victorious. You're correct. Iran stands to lose a lot of influence regionally if Syria, if the Assad regime goes under and it's overthrown, because that has been Iran's major ally in the region. It's the main conduit for Hezbollah and Iran's relationship with Hezbollah. So the Saudis, I think, are jockeying for position here. They're trying to, I think, they have come out recently and supported strongly criticism of the Assad regime, hoping that if that regime can go under, some sort of Sunni regime can take its place that will be more favorable to the Saudis than to the Iranians. The United States really, I think, isn't a factor in this debate. I think they're really trying to play catch up here. Over the last several months, a lot of things have changed, and everyone is sort of jockeying for position here. But the key, I think, variable is really the future of Syria. The future of Syria matters much more to the future of the politics of the Middle East than let's say, the future of Tunisia or Libya, which is somewhat geographically distant from many of the more centered and emotionally charged conflicts that revolve around the Israel-Palestine conflict, Iran's relationship with the region, Saudi Arabia's relationship with the region.
Well, it's no secret, though, surely, Nader Hashemi, that the Iranian appeal has been based upon their notion that we are the ones that will deliver freedom to the Palestinians and, by extension, defeat the Israelis. And that is their appeal to Islam, that we're the guys that are going to deliver Jerusalem, Al-Quds, you know, and they're suffering setbacks, as I mentioned, with their surrogates in Hamas because of what's happening in Syria. So it seems to be a moment where the U.S., you think they'd be doubling down, but they're not. And I'm just wondering whether the Palestinian statehood issue is going to play into the Iranians' hands, because the U.S. is not going to look good.
No, I think the Iranians are going to try and exploit that. If there's a veto of the resolution, either at the Security Council or at the General Assembly by the United Nations in any sort of alliance with European powers that reject the notion of a Palestinian state, the Iranian regime is going to take that to the bank and try and reinforce the argument that the West is structurally, ideologically opposed to Palestinian national rights. And I think the United States is actually very cognizant of that. That's why they don't want this vote to go to the Security Council or to the General Assembly, because it'll make the United States look very bad at the same time where Obama is trying to reach out to the Islamic world, has given a speech on May the 18th supporting the Arab Spring and the idea of freedom and self-determination. And so how do you square that with, you know, opposing self-determination for the Palestinians? So I think, you know, the Iranians actually are hoping for a veto at the UN Security Council or at the General Assembly. But the larger term picture here is, I think Iran is very nervous about the future trends in the Middle East. If, for example, democracy takes root in Egypt and Egypt reasserts itself as the voice of Arab and Islamic sort of nationalism in the region and starts to champion the rights of the Palestinians, well, that makes it much more difficult for the Iranians to do so. And so the idea here that somehow Iran is going to be a victor because of the Arab Spring, I think is one interpretation, one that I don't put a lot of stock in, because of these sort of developments for democracy and self-determination. There's also the Turkish factor here, and I think we should mention that, because as I speak, the Prime Minister of Turkey is in Egypt, and he's going on to Tunisia and to Libya, and he is really the sort of the voice he's a very popular voice and a popular politician now within the Arab world because of his outspoken position on the plight of the Palestinians, because of the fact that Turkey is an emerging democracy and a vibrant economy, and he's portrayed as sort of a model for the Arab world. I think that also worries the Iranians in many ways, because they want to be the voice of the oppressed and they don't want anyone else to usurp that position.
Right, while they're oppressing their own people. I mean,
Well, that's the irony of all of this, right? Iran claims to be, you know, supporting, at least rhetorically, the democratic revolutions in the Arab world, while at the same time crushing those same revolutions at home.
And the choice between the Iranians and the Saudis is a pretty dismal one. So little wonder that the Turks are looking good. And, of course, the Turkish prime minister, in terms of the Palestinian statehood, said it's not a choice, it's an obligation.
Right. No, and I agree. And I think the Turkish position here is much more in keeping with sort of basic principles of international law. It's a better model. I mean, among the rival sort of states, if you compare Turkey, Iran, and Saudi Arabia, the Turkish position is one that I think is more defensible and one that I think presents a better model for the future of the Arab world. So absolutely, I agree with you on that point.
Well, it's odd, though, that the Israelis have managed to offend everybody. They turned down the Saudi peace offer, which apparently offended the Saudis, and they're having a spat with Turkey. And they clearly have limited the ability for President Obama to do much. Nobody can lean on the Israelis. Look what just happened in New York. A safe Democratic House seat was lost over the issue of Obama or the Democrats not being sufficiently pro-Israel.
No, I agree. I think one of the problems here is that because the United States has wholeheartedly backed Israel for such a long time, effectively giving the Israelis a carte blanche to do whatever they want, there is a sense of arrogance and entitlement that the leaders of Israel have toward the politics of the broader Middle East and toward their relationship with the United States. There is a sense that they can do whatever they want and there won't be a heavy cost to pay. So now you're starting to see some of the consequences of this sort of one-sided ideological position manifesting itself. Israel's relationships with Turkey are going down the drain. Israel's relationship with Egypt now is very strained. And its relationship with the Palestinians and the rest of the Islamic world has gone from bad to worse. So I think we're really headed toward a crisis moment. The sad thing here, as you alluded to, is that the Israelis are not going to, I think, unilaterally change course unless there's some pressure from their closest ally, the United States. But of course, the United States and the Obama administration, according to my interpretation, is not going to take any serious measure to put pressure on the Israelis to agree to international law and to agree to a two-state settlement because of domestic American politics. There's a sense that, you know, if Obama next week vetoes at the United Nations a resolution on Palestinian statehood, that will be good for him when it comes to next year's presidential election.
Well, just in closing, Ahmadinejad is coming to the United Nations bearing gifts. He's bringing, I think, 1,000 copies of a book that he's put together entitled Documents on Iran's Occupation by the Allies During World War II. I don't quite know what he expects from that, but that's apparently his gift to the world.
Well, that's the first time I'm actually hearing this, but I'm not surprised at all. I think, you know, Ahmadinejad is going to use this trip to shore up his own sagging reputation back at home, and he's going to try and get as much media attention as possible. I'm willing to bet that he's going to invoke again the question of the Nazi Holocaust. He's going to say provocative things, and he's going to try and get maximum sort of exposure and attention on this trip so that he can take it back home and hopefully revive his own sagging political fortunes.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Nada Hashimi.
A pleasure to be with you. Take care.
And again, I've been speaking with Nada Hashimi, who is a professor of Middle East and Islamic politics at the Joseph Korbel School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's the author of a new book, The People Reloaded, The Green Movement and the Struggle for Iran's Future. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment talking about the Euro crisis.
The Bible's blood and Torah's death, the Quran is new. If you burn them all together, you get close to the truth still. They're pouring over Sanskrit under Ivy League moons while shadows lengthen in the sun. Cast on a school of meditation built to soften the times and hold us at the center of the spiral lines. It's knocking over fences, crossing property lines, pouring